Well, I'm supposed to announce the speaker here. You know, our speaker, his name is Matt, and I've known Matt for quite some time now, and he's always been active and everything, but he told me something this morning that I was not aware of. He said he's never spoken here, so I think we're wasting time by letting him sit there, so come on.
My name's Matt, I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is May 31st, 1994. My home group is Colonies North. I have a sponsor. His name is Larry H. He knows he's my sponsor. He's moving out of town, so he also knows that I'm in a process of looking for a new sponsor, but we stay in touch about that. I sponsor people, both in person and by mail. I have a minimum of 4 meetings a week right now, one of which is a treatment facility. My current commitment at my home group is the Grapevine Committee, and Jen and I are on the Grapevine Committee. Way to go. So while I'm talking about the Grapevine, Yoli spoke last week, and she talked. One of the things she mentioned was her favorite issue of the Grapevine magazine. It had 3 big letters on the front, E-G-O. She said, ego. I can relate to that. And when she said that, I could relate to that. And 8 years ago, I volunteered to show up when they needed a few more speakers assigned at the 2010, and it was about the Grapevine magazine, so I researched. Harry Thibault, who was a psychiatrist, worked with early AAs, and I think the Grapevine, I love the Grapevine, it ties into the spirit of early AA when I read those old articles. And this is a non-alcoholic, but non-alcoholics can understand and have compassion. They may not identify. But he talked about the astounding capacity for the rebirth of the ego. So that's going to be kind of a theme as I speak here. I have an ego that rebuilds itself relentlessly. And therefore, these things I've talked about by being active and also having a prayer life and having trying to stay in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous and keep an open mind to what you all suggest I try to employ in my life. To the degree that I do that, I've got this wonderful, wonderful life now. But I'm going to tell you a little bit about how I got here, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So I want a shameless plug first, though. I know Bob reminded me that I'm speaking only to the group, but the club was here when I needed it. And so I'm wearing my golf tie for Mike and Curtis. And I'm not sure if I can make this tournament, but I want to support it. I have my membership card in my pocket. It's paid up through October. It's a shameless plug. How much did I spend on drinking, like Wendy was talking about? It was unbelievable the amounts I spent on drinking. And this place is open. I love Club 12. I love the fact that it's here and is welcoming and open. So it was here when I needed it. Okay. So grew up in an Irish Catholic family. My dad worked for General Tire. He moved our family from Akron to Pittsburgh, where I was born, to Rockford, Illinois, where I grew up. I was the last of 7 kids. When I was about 8, it was a chaotic. Imagine an Irish Catholic stereotype, and that's my family. So a lot of drinking going on, and probably when I was 8 or 9 years old, my mom was telling me my dad was sick. So the concept of the illness of alcoholism from a very early age was introduced to me. And when I was 9 years old or so, I'm not sure at the exact date, I stole my first beer out of the basement refrigerator, Blatt's beer. Yeah, there were cases of those brown bottles in our house, and I knew that one wouldn't be missed. And it wasn't, but I didn't much like the taste, but I drank the whole thing. At the time, I wouldn't tell you that I was drinking for effect, but obviously in hindsight, that's what I was doing. I wanted to have that feeling, and it gave me that feeling. So as I grew, drinking, of course, gained more and more importance in my life. And I started having experiences. My first really serious drunk was freshman in high school, 13 years old. Two buddies and myself, one of them had a bottle of bourbon. I don't know how he got it. His parents were home, so he mixed them into 3 tumblers, mixed it with orange juice with pulp. This is very sophisticated drinking. Drank those down very quickly, laughed, had a blast, and then I blacked out. And then I passed out. This is a pattern now. And established this is the first time in my life. And I woke up in the middle of the night, and I had to call for help. I had to get the hell out of there. I felt sick. Called my brother's, his girlfriend's house, because I thought, you know, he volunteered to give me a ride home. Woke up their whole house. This is 1972. And he's gone. Woke up my house, and he came and got me. That's the only time I ever opened a car door and puked. I knew that hard liquor I could not handle very much, so it was mostly beer. Beer caused other problems that I'll tell you about. I thought I was managing better, and I wouldn't think about it in those terms, but in hindsight, you know, anything to manage my drinking, because why would you give it up? I just need to do it better. So in college, I did okay in high school, I did okay in college, and I didn't know how driven I was back at that time by, you know, this psychologist could help me understand that in hindsight that it's all about fear of discovery. I was that seventh kid, I wasn't as good as my older brothers, I'll never measure up kind of deal. And although that's a delusion, that's a false belief, and I am unbelievably driven by that. So I'm an alcoholic because the alcohol has this effect on me where it's euphoric. After a few of those, that all goes away. After a few more, I've also got this illness where I always thought I was making a decision to have another one. How come I never made the decision not to have another one? You know, in hindsight, I know that once it hit my body, I learned that after I got here, that this thing is physical, but my mind is telling me all the time to get back around to that drinking. So in college, I started waking up in funny places from time to time. One time I woke up outside in the rocks in my underwear, and this guy saw me. I was like, I don't know, you know, what do when you wake up like that? I just, you know, run. So in 1981, I moved to Texas and fell in love with Sixth Street and all the bars down there, and Stevie Ray Vaughan, the blues, and all that kind of business. And you know, there's times that after the bars are closed, I don't know where the hell my car is. There's times I got home, I don't know how the hell I got home. Is my car out there? And I think in hindsight, oh my gosh, I mean, there's three field sobriety tests that I passed at a different time and age when I was drunk. And I did one time, company picnic. I'm about 23 years old, had a wonderful time all day at this picnic, and then we went, this is in Austin, went to the Horseshoe Lounge on South Lamar, and you know that, we're drinking after the picnic and playing pool. I'm winning at pool, which is the strangest thing, and driving home by myself, decide to stop at Dunkin' Donuts. Pretty smart move. It's about 2:33 in the morning, and this is where I discovered passing out. Somehow the police, I don't know if they were called or they were already there, it's Dunkin' Donuts, or... You know, I don't know. I might have been friendly with them, and then I just passed out. But they couldn't wake me up, so they lifted me up off the chair, putting handcuffs on me, bringing me out to my 79 hatchback where the dome light was still on and the cooler was in the back, and they're laughing as they look at the empties and the fulls in the cooler. So it was public intoxication. So I never did that again. I never stopped at Dunkin' Donuts. But drinking obviously wasn't the problem. And so I continued. When I met my wife, she accepted my drinking. And it was wonderful. It was a conviviality. It was a celebration. It was a joy of living. And early on, there were signs. When we were having one of those deep talks the first time, she had been given this little kitten who lived 22 years, but still a kitten. And we're walking around her neighborhood, and I'm holding this kitten, and we're talking and having this deep conversation about the world and life and love, and then the next morning at the breakfast table, she carries on this conversation, looking at me deeply, meaningfully, and I'm looking at her blankly, and she says, "You don't remember, do you?" And I said, "I mean, what do you do? There are so many times I'm caught in that, I have no idea. You know, I'm black." So that's blacking out, passing out. Also early on in our relationship, we ran the movie Avalon, which I still have not seen. And we got to her place. I got up to excuse myself. She paused it. I guess I went to the restroom. Never came back. She couldn't find me. She turned it back on. And at the end of the movie, she's looking around. She finally finds me. She has this a dining room table that's glass, four chairs snugged in, and I am on two of those chairs. They're still at 90 degrees, but I'm on two of those chairs completely naked. How do you explain that? That's another theme that goes on. So blacking out, passing out, and that gets worse. If a normal person would say, maybe drinking, maybe I'm drinking a little bit too much, but I just want to drink. I just need to learn to drink better. So over the period of the 8 years, the drinking became more and more of a problem in our relationship. And towards the end, it was the kind of thing where it was an ugly situation, where the sound of another beer can in our house to her was like this emotional gunshot kind of thing. It was like, pow. So I might be in the kitchen. Of course, I drank some on the way home. There's got to be at least a case in the fridge. And if I'm going out to the kitchen, she's got her ears up. So I get that next can and go, did I ever hide it? No, I never hide it. Hit it? Yes, I hit it. I hid the behavior. But or if I'm in just a nasty mood, I just come back out with that beer can and just right at her face. So it's just little ugly things like that. So at any rate, in 1994, and I knew because of my dad's experience, I had seen him get sober. I had seen rooms like this. I actually lived, my mom divorced him, which was a big deal back then, but she allowed him to have visitation rights. I lived with him my senior year in high school. I saw these happy people. They're the only happy people I'd ever seen. I got an honest picture of AA, and my dad was immersed in it. And I was touched by his spirituality. It was a real epiphany that this man had changed, that the God that I grew up with, who was off there somewhere, was actually active in his life and changed him. And he had his own understanding of God that touched mine. So I knew for a long time I'd have to quit drinking. And I even kind of had this inkling that I would probably have this spiritual longing after I quit drinking from talking to my dad. And I did. I could even say, when I quit drinking, so my wife got pregnant, we decided to get married, I'm going out with a bang. The night before our wedding, it's my last night of drinking, I'm having a great time by myself when everybody's off in bed. Her parents came down to witness her wedding. So I don't know what time in the morning, but it was early on the morning of May 31st, 1994. She comes out, and I'm in the utility room of our little house. And I don't know which end of me is sticking out, but it's completely naked. And right down the hallway, her parents are sleeping. You know, there's a bathroom and this little bedroom. And she's just trying to save me the embarrassment. She's trying to lift me up off the ground. And I don't know if it's that time or not, but she said, what, are you trying to be like your dad? And I'm like, and I was pissed. She is interfering with my good time. She said, she tells me, you've gone and done it now. You've really effing done it now. And I'm just pissed at her. And anyway, she got, I don't know how I made it into the bedroom, because I don't think she, I think she says I got another beer. I mean, she's not going to ruin my last night of drinking, right? So that was just that kind of ugliness. Anyway, we got married the next day. Yeah, her parents witnessed the wedding. She right away had a miscarriage, and then we tried again. She had another miscarriage. We weren't really trying to have kids, so after that we just didn't. But I quit drinking, and then I did start having this spiritual hunger. So I started going back to the church of my forefathers. I think they're, because I was really trying to do this thing, I bought one of those blue books you guys have. I might have gone to one or two meetings, but over the period of 8 years, I knew that I could never drink again. And I knew that that just wasn't an option. It was, but I had no idea, in hindsight now, that I was working the second half of the, I had worked the first half of the first step. I knew I'm powerless over, I didn't like the word powerless, but I learned here that my body chemistry is different than normal people, and I can't control my body chemistry. When I drink, I want more, period. Normal people don't drink that way. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm an alcoholic like you, after going through the book with a guy and having him share his experience out of that book. Because I couldn't, when I was in a dry period of 8 years, it was basically the thanks for the information stage. It's in More About Alcoholism, it says, you know, I'm really rather impressed with that queer mental twist you talk about, the peculiar mental blank spot, or however you guys phrase that stuff, but I think I'm not quite as bad off as you. And I just tried to stay out of this thing. So on the outside, things might look great, but I'm getting more and more. It started out with, I could have a conversation with my wife where I don't exactly agree with her, and it's okay to just be on the opposite side of a conversation. I didn't realize how driven I was with wanting to be right and wanting her to agree with me, and how that got worse and worse over time, to the point after 8 years, she's telling me, turned around one time when we were talking, she walked out of the room. I said, let's keep talking. She said, no. She turned around and said, I'm not going to take this abuse anymore. I think I might have already been here when that happened. So I didn't get better right away, obviously, with the removal of the alcohol. And I can take something perfectly good, like the religion of my forefathers, and turn it into something where I'm mean to my wife. I'm trying as hard as I can to do that. I'm going to therapy. I'm getting up early in the morning. I'm reading self-help books. I took spiritual direction. I really honestly tried as hard as I could with this brain separated from alcohol to manage well. And I was, and it wasn't until a guy took me through the, so I was just busted and beat after 8 years. We're having dinner with my stepmother, and my wife says our marriage is falling apart. And she said it out loud. And so now I have to face that. And that was in May, as ironically, May 31st of 2002. It was on my sobriety date. Don't know if that's odd, God, or anything in between. Doesn't matter. It's when it happened. And I decided, you know, my stepmother is celebrating 50 years in Al-Anon this fall. Wonderful, beautiful woman. And she was there. My dad died in 87. It was just a beautiful thing. Just the spirituality that they had was very attractive to me. And anyway, so she suggested AA for me. What a surprise. Suggested Al-Anon for my wife. No surprise there either. My wife went to a few meetings. It's not for her. Fair enough. I came back in June, and on a Saturday at 11 a.m., I came here. And Sylvia and Ned and Jonathan and Bob J. were standing around outside that room right there, and they made me feel welcome. And I remember that. I remember that very well. I don't remember a lot of that meeting. I remember Ned giving me a desire chip. And on that chip, he said, "It's everything I need to recover." He talked about the three legacies of the program, unity, service, and recovery. He talked about the prayer, and he talked about honesty, to thine own self be true. So the concept of honesty, you know, I need you to get honest with myself. I'm glad I'm sober now, because I really want to talk about the steps. It wasn't immediately great. I was just an emotional basket case. I had been trying so hard, and now I can't trust my own brain. I have to surrender to the fact that I might have to try something different than my ideas. You know, my ideas, when they come out of my head, they've got this instant approval, right? It's my idea. And this is one of the large problems I have, is that I disagree. If someone says something I disagree with, I had no idea how driven I was with trying to stay one step ahead. During that period of trying to manage and trying to get sober and trying to achieve a spirituality, I would get up early in the morning. I'd get up at 3:45 in the morning at one point for a couple years. I'm journaling, I'm praying, I'm meditating, I'm writing about the same things I'm writing about now, seeking God's will, all these kind of things, these concepts. There was a priest, gave, when I talked about my problem in the 12 steps, he recommended this little Bible, Serenity for Every Day, I think it's called. It takes a step and a passage and a meditation and one for every day of the year. I did that for 2.5 years on my own. So making this honest attempt, what's blocking me? What's blocking me, for whatever reason, is a program of action is what I needed. And to me, that's the thing that's made the difference. So being willing to come to a meeting is an act of faith and something different. It's not my idea. And then the unmanageability is what forced it. You know, my marriage has fallen apart. I was having thoughts of suicide. I had been fired from a job after 7 years of being separated from alcohol. I was just this driven mess. When I would get up and I'd do all that stuff in the morning, and then when I drive to work, my mind, in hindsight, my mind was always trying to predict every potential scenario that I would come across, every person I was going to talk to, because I had my top 10 list of things to do. I had them prioritized, and I'd be thinking about the people involved and what the situations were, and I wanted to have a contingency plan for every single conversation. Yeah, that's my insanity. It's exhausting. It's exhausting. I can't, you know, I just, oh. So always wanted to be one step ahead and create this impression on you that's just, I'm just the right amount of smart and humble that you really like. You know, that's my kind of insanity. And so it was unworkable. It didn't work. And I didn't find that out till I started to come here. When I heard at my home group, a man named Jose say that, I love him, God rest his soul, he said, "I want to have the answer before you ask the question. I want to have the answer before you ask the question." He understood my insanity. He understood that I was that way, and he felt that way too. And these are some of the reasons I drank. I drank at you. I drank at situations. I drank to stop this craziness in my head. But I didn't recognize it until I came here. So that ego was driving and relentless and just off to an extreme. So the first stop was I needed to stop drinking. And it really, I think because I was seeking God, the obsession to drink was relieved. I was making an honest attempt to seek God of my understanding. But that second big surrender for me was just, my life sucks. It's not working out right. You know, my ideas don't work. So I'm going to try this AA idea. And at that first meeting, so Ned, after the meeting, everybody's talking at me. It's my first meeting. I misunderstood. I had been to a few meetings, but it was my first meeting here. But they gave me the whole treatment, which I needed. And after the meeting, Ned says, "Hey, we're going to Jason's. You want to come with us?" I said, "Sure." He said, "You can ride with me." He knew I wasn't going to go. I mean, I'm so grateful for those little acts of kindness. Ned also called me once and arranged to pick me up near my house and took me to the Bulverde group. You know, Dr. Bob in his last talk talked about those little acts of kindness. And those are the things that since then I've tried to pass on, that Ned passed on to me. Jonathan, after that meeting, I don't remember where it was, but he was saying, you know, they told me to, when I got here, to get a schedule and a map and just see, go to a lot of different meetings and just see what I'm willing to do. And so he said I did that. And, you know, he said that. I liked what he had, so I did that. I got a schedule, a map. I went to a lot of different meetings. And when I got to Colonies North, started at 8:15, it kind of worked with my work schedule, and Danny came across the parking lot and made me feel welcome. And so I started, they had a beginner's meeting there, and I asked permission to go, because I'd been separated from alcohol for 8 years. That's what made me think, I'm not really an alcoholic. I didn't need AA to stop. You guys talk about in this book how you got to have AA to stop drinking. Well, you know, luckily I'd hear things like Willard at a big book study say, "I'm just like every other alcoholic. My case is different." So, you're hearing my case. This is my case. You know, it's just my experience. And I've got that, you know, thank God it broke through the terminal uniqueness that I'm not different. That, you know, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, the promises appear. And I think it was Jim B. said, you know, if I don't do those promises, they'll disappear. And that's sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly also. So, I went to a lot of different meetings. And then Colonies North became, everybody's talking about home group. Everybody's talking about a sponsor. Have you got a sponsor yet? So after the beginner's meeting, I asked the guy to be my sponsor. And then it was really working up that courage to actually call the guy, you know, pick up the 500-pound phone and actually call the guy. And I remember being out on my out in the backyard calling him. And it's strange, right? I mean, why am I outside, you know, calling? I haven't been call my sponsor, just, you know. But anyway, I did. I called him, and then I got over that, and I remember I called him, and so this concept of being able to tell someone everything that's going inside my head, the principle of this complete disclosure helps me get honest with myself. I've got a guy that I sponsor now, and he calls it soundboarding. That's a great term for it, because I don't have, my sponsors never had the answers. They didn't claim to. Every time I'd tell him a situation, he'd say, "Well, Matt, here's what happened to me. I can't relate to this. I had this happen," and Mike, and he'd talk about his own experience. But he understood. And that fact that he understood and I'm no longer alone was a huge deal. I started calling him so often. One time I called him and he said, "Matt, you know, I had to realize at some point that not the whole world does not revolve around my feelings and how I feel at this point in time." And so, you know, there's a balance to everything, right? I called him right there where I was just talking about something that maybe I just needed to get through. And one time, then I started calling him from work. You know, I called him from work. I told him about the litany of the day. You know, this isn't going right. That's not going right. And this isn't going right. And he said, "Well, Matt, let me get this straight. Things aren't going right because they're not going the way you think they should go, right?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "And we've talked enough to know that you, even when you got your way, things didn't work out that well, right?" "Yeah, that's right. So when you manage your life, it kind of doesn't work out that well, right? And you've told me that you've got a faith in something infinite, something bigger, no bush league pinch hitter kind of deal. You've got faith in some higher power, right?" "Yeah. I'd suggest you get that involved." It's like a blank wall, right? Come on, I wanted something more than that. Because here I am thinking about these real situations, and again, it's not having done an inventory yet, I'm in fear. But luckily, things, I mean, hearing encouragements from people in the group, by the way, I'm going to that beginner's meeting, and a guy named Steve Z comes in and says he heard about a guy named Big Book Dick that told him you don't have to be on steps 10 and 11 to read 84 through 88, and it's a good idea to start reading 84 through 88. And so I started doing that, and it made a big difference for me. It started a prayer life. It started to think I could read those pages and feel like I'm connected and I'm doing something in AA, and I could share about that in meetings. And God rest his soul, his services this afternoon. He helped so many people, and he was never my sponsor, but he sponsored a guy that touched my life and is still one of my close friends in AA. So I'd hear things like that. I heard another thing from a speaker in our group, a guy named Todd. He spoke very, very briefly. A speaker meeting like this, he'd be done by, literally he was done by now at the speaker meeting. And anyway, I'm not done. I think I'm on step one. Todd told the story about his sister. He had this relationship where just he hated her, and he asked the sponsor what could he do about it, and the sponsor said, well, you know that part of the book where it talks about we were tornadoes roaring through their lives? And he said, yeah, well, on the other end of that next paragraph, it says we pray for patience and tolerance and kindliness and love each morning. He said, yeah. He said, well, try that. And if you can't do all four, just try one of those things. Just try to get one of those things in that relationship. And he said, well, I can't love her. You know, I can't be patient with her. And I know I can't be kind to her. I guess I'll just tolerate her. I guess I can just tolerate her. And this idea of tolerance, it's the stopping of the ego. Harry Tebow talked about stopping the ego. You know, we had to stop drinking. I have to stop my bad behavior. Stop fighting, Matt. Just stop. Pause when agitated. I mean, that was explained to me. Those are such valuable things, but the stop fighting. We cease fighting anything or anybody. I hear Cliff M., an old-timer in a group, God rest his soul, and he said he was a dock worker in New Jersey for, you know, that's how he grew up, and then he was in treatment, and he was an old-timer. When he couldn't drive anymore, we'd give him a ride to meetings, and I got to know him real well. And I remember him saying, I ain't got to prove nothing to nobody, and I ain't got to fight nothing to nobody. And it's like a little glimmer of hope that I can do that. I can try that. And for points in time, I'd stop. So with my wife, what that meant is, here I am. I got myself into an argument again. I didn't mean to be in this argument. And I stop. And she says, no, go ahead. Just, you know, you got it going, man. Keep going. No, nope. I'm stopping. Stop. She's ready to fight now. No, I got to stop. Just stop fighting, Matt. Stop. Just stop. And then it might progress to the point where she can see a look on my face. We've known each other a long time. But I stop and I don't verbalize it. And then eventually, I stop the brainstorm. The brainstorm is a big word for me. Brainstorm and the grouch are not for us. Learned about it in step four, but heard about it beforehand. And so, for those of you who don't know, the current term of brainstorm is more about, when I looked up in the dictionary, spontaneous thinking and creativity. The Disney Corporation made it famous. There's a whiteboard. There's no bad ideas. Anybody say whatever's on your mind to get creativity going. This is a current usage of it. But I looked it up in a 1970 dictionary. It's a sudden, violent disturbance of the mind. That's me. A sudden, violent disturbance of the mind. Uncontrollable mental outburst. That's me. I'm yelling at people in my head. I may not be yelling at my wife, but I'm still yelling at her in my head. But that's progress. And that was another thing Jose said. He would go from nothing to rage, so anger was actually an improvement. So it's progress. And it's reality. It's trying to apply these things. And so I knew my life was unmanageable. I got a sponsor. Things sucked. And he introduces this concept. In step two, as we're going through the literature, the two things that stick out to me is, I can't screw with this idea, God. It's bigger than human understanding, but it is what it is. He said, well, why don't you just keep an open mind? So that was a suggestion. Just try to keep an open mind. And the other thing is to quit the debating society. Again, quit. Stop, Matt. Stop fighting. Stop fighting ideas. Just stop fighting and keep an open mind are big principles for me. And I do think there's something bigger than me. I know that there's the principle. I know that God works through AA and there's sober people that have these happy lives. So now we're going through the book to step three, and he introduces the actor. Oh, my gosh. I read that book by myself. I didn't think I was the actor. And he shares something out of experience about how he's always trying to manipulate, always trying to get his way, always trying to do, you know. And he said that, I said, oh my God, that's me. I'm always, as I described to you, my wanting to stay ahead and create just the right impression that I'm the actor, and it doesn't work out quite right. So I try harder. And then I'm trying to wrest satisfaction and happiness. And it's just, I'm a producer of confusion, selfishness, self-centeredness. And even though I was trying on my own to do these things, I could relate to the fact that I could have moral philosophical convictions galore and not live up to them. But with another alcoholic, for some reason, being completely honest, I was able to get honest with myself about those things. And there was a speaker tape at the time. I heard this guy say, his sponsor told him, you know, you could turn your will and your life over to the care of a jackass and it would be better. It kind of hurt my feelings when I heard it. You know, I was like, what's he talking about? I mean, it was this radical idea, but then now I recognize again, it's my ego trying to run the whole show, my little plans and designs. I'm so interested in them. I'm driven by self-delusion and self-pity. I'm walking around. I've got preemptive strikes in mind because I just assume the worst about people. I know you're going to say something nasty, so I'm ready, you know. And I step on the toes. I feel threatened. My second sponsor helped me feel threatened, so I lash out. And I might lash out mentally. I might lash out verbally. But, you know, I'm driven by all of these fears, self-centered fear. And so recognizing that with someone else and getting on my knees with another sponsor and saying a third step prayer. You know, I still do that. He told me to try that out. Try saying a third step prayer in your meetings. Reflect on, in the mornings. Just try saying it on your knees and see what you think. Give it a try. What do you, you know? I said, okay, I'll give it a try. And that was probably 16 years ago, and I haven't stopped. He never said this. He never said to stop. So it helps me to reflect. And then I heard the other Yoli say that, you know, all 12 steps are included in that third step, if I reflect on it. And at any rate, the taking of the step was going through the book and then saying it on my knees. Now I'm in the fourth step. And I was, got another Club 12 story. This is the 70th, I don't know what anniversary it was, but this would have been 2004 or so maybe, because I was taking my time with these steps. 2003, 2004, and my wife was out of town, so I'm going to, instead of writing my fourth step, I'm going to go to a meeting at Club 12. And I showed up here, and damn, it was the anniversary. So out here, it was all busy, nothing in the announcement. I had to go to the smoking room. And I needed to go to a meeting. I went to that smoking room. And after the meeting, the chairperson says, what step are you working on? I said, step four. He said, bull, you know. Is it terrible? Can you swear? He said, bull. And he finished it off. He said, bull, if you were working your fourth step, you'd be home writing right now. And so he offered to get a piece of paper and show how it was shown to him. He got out the book, he showed me the columns, he showed me the fourth column. My sponsor had been really trying to take it easy on me and kind of do the first two columns of that resentment list. But I called my sponsor, he said, why not? My wife's out of town. You know, here I go, waiting months and months and months and take a few hours and they're blurted out. There's my first attempt at a four step. And then my experience was I went over that with my sponsor. So because I could not see my part. I couldn't see what part of me had affected in that third column, and I couldn't definitely had a hard time seeing where I'd been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and afraid. But going over it with my sponsor really helped. So that's kind of how I pass it along to other people. Some people, you know, this is just my experience. What I've learned is that these are spiritual exercises from one alcoholic to another, and it's so beautiful that when I sit down with another alcoholic, that I learn, I mean, it is such a privilege now to sit side by side with somebody as he works his steps, and I get to work with him as he gets honest with himself about these things, and he gets what he gets out of it, and I'm not telling him what to do. I'm just sharing my experience. Bless you. So so a lot of that was when I did the fifth step with my sponsor, and I could talk a lot about the resentments against my wife, but I gotta move on through the steps here. Justified resentments are the worst, right? They're the worst kind. That's all I got to say. They still a resentment. I got to get rid of it. I'm the one drinking poison, hoping the other person's die. You know, futility and hopelessness. That's it. My ego wanting to run the show and not seeing her side of things and not having, you know, when I let go, when I quit trying to manage and cajole my wife, man, she got so much better. It was literally, it's so practical. Just stop, Matt. And when that, I heard a speaker say that allows God to get in the middle of you and the other person if I stop fighting. So when I stopped criticizing my wife, or stopped giving her suggestions, it was amazing how much better she got. So when I did the fifth step with my sponsor, he told me to go home, take that book down. Took the book down, you know, and read the first five proposals, and it said, "We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better." And he was so big on honesty, Matt. Bring all your honesty into whatever you think of God, whatever you think of that. He says, because my God can handle it. If I'm angry, whatever, don't dress yourself up in your prayer. Just get in there and tell God whatever you got on your mind. So honesty, I'm trying to be honest with myself. Can I really think that I know God better through this process of doing these first five steps? And as I was reflecting on that, I had this unbelievable wave of pure relaxation and joy and gratitude, and everything is okay. Everything will be okay. Everything always has been okay. Everything is okay no matter what. I don't know how long that lasted, but that was a definite awakening. And I've had other small ones like that, but that was an unbelievably good one. And in step six, when we started to see my patterns of behavior, this wanting to be right, you know, one of my sponsors said, "You're really just afraid of being wrong." Absolutely true. I'm terrified of being wrong. But the symptom is I want to be right. So I gotta fight that symptom. And the practical things that happen every day. Stop trying to be right. So one night after the meeting, my habit to call, and it's at 9:30 at night because Colonies meets 8:15 and 9:15. He was always available. I finish up the conversation. One night, I'm outside in the garage, and I'm thinking about the garage and all the messes in there and the crap and this and that. And the next night, I'm talking to him, and I turn around and I look at the garage, and I go, "There's a garage. I have a garage. There's a car in the garage. It operates. I have a house. I have this home." I turn around and I look at the stars. I felt, like Kim at my home group says, a 3D effect, that it's here. I'm part of this world, this universe, and I'm connected somehow because this guy knows every single thing about me, and he's not running. He accepts me for what I am, and he knows everything. So that illuminating every nook and cranny, that has been a principle that stays with me, that if I'm completely honest with someone else about every little thing, there's that sponsor relationship means a lot to me for that. And it's such a privilege to be that close mouth friend for someone else. So anyway, step seven was, he had me think about what am I really not willing to let go of, and just be completely honest about that and ask for God's help. And again, say the seven-step prayer, and that it's just today. And I don't get to choose which defects are removed. I just try to show up, ask God to remove the defects, try to act on these principles. This is where the rubber meets the road. And then we're going over the list, and there's in the 12 and 12, the thorough, exhaustive research of all my relationships, that was very helpful for me. And I needed his guidance in going over each one of these harms that I had done. And when doing that, I just also heard things in meetings. And I heard people in step nine meetings talk about, you know, admitting I was wrong, number one, talking about what I did wrong, number two, offering to make it right. This is not about apologizing. And then, did I leave anything out? And shut up. And stop and listen, and that's so powerful. But each one of these things, my sponsor helped guide me in the beginning about, and if there's a tough one, but once I got the pattern down, okay, go down the list and keep them going. And one I can share at the podium is, this is my second trip through the steps, and my sponsor, and I remembered all these guys I told you about incontinence briefly. So I had all these drinking things were friends' couches, friends' beds, friends, you know. I had just woken up wet, you know. It's like nasty, ugly. And so here it is 20 years later, and I remember these guys, and I look for them and find them. And I'm talking about my sponsor that I had remembered all these things my second trip through. And my sponsor says, "Oh, it's the Matt Mullen tour." I was a little sensitive still at that point. I didn't really want to hear that, right? You know, it's like at any rate, but it rekindled. When I did this, it rekindled relationships. There was a guy in Washington, D.C. that I borrowed his Volkswagen and burned out the clutch one night, driving drunk. And I lied about it to him. This has been 1979. I'm calling him in 2005, 2006. And he's like, and we had kind of, the cards had dropped off and we'd lost touch with each other. But he felt like it was so good that I got back in touch with him. Whatever you're doing is really great. My sponsor said, "You think about what the value of that was, and, and contribute something to a charity he would like. So I did that. So I thought about the value of a clutch in a Volkswagen. I did not compound the interest over 35 years, I'll be honest with you. So. But at any rate, it rekindled the relationship. And I went to Washington, D.C., and where he was living, and stayed with them, and went to meetings up there. And it's like, I mean, you know, the unbelievable. So this idea that this reconstruction of our lives, it's a long period of reconstruction, and that I'm the idea is I bring, what am I bringing into it? What am I doing from my side? In step 9, for the rest of my life, I need to try to improve how I do things at work. How am I wearing my program is the most important thing. So continue to take inventory. For me, that means really part of that is staying active. And I do not do a formal 10-step at the night or in the morning, but when I have an emotional hangover, I do. This morning, guess what? I wrote about being afraid to speak here. And, you know, I'm afraid. I'm driven by what other people think. I still have those fears. It's human to have fears, of course, but I recognize it's illusory. I can't control it, but it's none of my business what anybody thinks about me. My job is to show up, suit up, and just share my experience with honesty. So, anyway, the talk a lot about step 10 and just that it's an ongoing thing. Whatever it takes for me to feel emotional pain, the emotional pain is what usually gets me back into doing an inventory. It's when I don't do it necessarily every day, but if I got a hangover, I got to do something about it. I can't live with resentment very long. I can't live with this stuff. That's the good part, isn't it? And I don't drink over it anymore. I may not be perfect, but I don't drink. And if I have pain, I do something about it. And it's activity in AA that gives me a barometer. You know, it's by being active in AA that I people know and recognize where I'm at, and I know and recognize where I'm at. So, step 11, I told you about pages 84 through 88 are still, so, and I go back to page 83 too, because after Todd told that story, it says in there that, you know, we pray for patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love. The spiritual life is not a theory. You know, my wife didn't want to hear me say, I'm sorry, I wore out, I'm sorry, right? She wanted to see different behavior. So it's my behavior that will convince her more than my words. 10 or 20 years of drinking did make a skeptic out of her for me. So I've got to behave differently. I've got to have different conduct. And that just, it's going to be a lifelong thing, because Tebow said it's astounding the ability of the ego to rebuild itself. And it's also, I don't have the violent mental outbursts as often, the sudden and violent brainstorms, thank goodness, but those can happen too. But luckily I recognize it now, and I can see that it's a trouble spot. Heck, it's even trouble if I start keeping score at home, right? She didn't do this, she didn't do that, she didn't do this, I did this, you know. That's a bad symptom. That's a bad symptom. Kind of like rehearsing conversations in my head. I don't do that anymore either, thank God. But when I do, that's a symptom. And I recognize I got to get back to an inventory. What's wrong inside of me? It's that spiritual axiom in step 10. So step 12 is, you know, I did have awakenings. I continue to have awakenings. I think I'm going to have awakenings for the rest of my life, because I only tapped the thing just a little bit. And I do try to carry the message. When I thanked him for making me feel welcome in Club 12, he said, pass it on. I'm sure that Ned told me to pass it on. Sylvia would tell me to pass it on. Jonathan would tell me to pass it on. And so I really do try to be an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I have a life. I know I would have, I mean, I had thoughts of suicide. I was miserable. What kind of life is that? And I know my life's, you know, sucked. Whether I killed myself or not, it sucked. I was miserable. I owe my life literally to Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember Jose saying that too. I owe my life to this program of recovery. So it's the program of actions. He also said, I come here to get my bearings. And I love that, because that's, again, without Alcoholics Anonymous, my mind and my ego starts rebuilding itself and I start thinking badly. It's just the nature of how I am still. I know a lot of you are probably way past that, but me, I gotta have meetings, I gotta have frequent meetings, I gotta have contact with alcoholics, and I love, you know, when I'm sitting with a guy and going through the book and sharing from the heart, that language of the heart comes out. When I hear it in meetings, I hear you sharing your experience with honesty, that language of the heart comes out. That's a miracle. The joy, the freedom from that crap inside my head, the hope, you know. That's what I get in Alcoholics Anonymous. So, having had a spiritual awakening as a result to try to carry the message and then practice the principles. Again, this is a design for living. And if I don't employ it in my life, if I try, you know, and I just, it just happens. The ego comes back from, you know, it doesn't say, scream at me, Matt, you got to take a drink. It's coming back saying, you know, that conversation wasn't quite right. You got to think about it a little bit. You know, ruminate on that conversation a little bit. See if you can work it over. See if you can make it work out differently in your head than it worked out in reality. That's how my ego is going to start sneaking back in. It's going to start making me feel uncomfortable about what is. And what is actually beautiful. Life is beautiful. Yes, there's pain. There's problems. And the God of my understanding works through Alcoholics Anonymous to help us all deal with reality and find reality and find joy. And even in the tragedies, we come together and we help each other. And so it is so, I'm so grateful to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous because it has given me a life. I realized when I thought about this, when I talked, I did think about this talk that I, you know, my wife early on was like, you know, you get up in the morning, you go to work, you may or may not come home, you go to a meeting, you get home at 10 o'clock at night, you get up the next day and you do the same thing. What kind of a marriage is that? However, over time, she has in every variation said, maybe you need a meeting. She doesn't want me at home if I need a meeting. And there have been times where she said that loudly. There have been other times when she said, most of the time now, she is just the kindest thing. When we go on vacation, I go to meetings, and she is so great to see Alcoholics Anonymous in other places, and it connects me. I feel plugged in. I feel part of, you know, being a part of rather than a part of, you know, not a part of God's world. That's another one of those promises. And that in here, my experience, that first page of working with others where it says, our unique experience, each one of us, that gave me hope. Our unique drinking experience can be used to help somebody else. And so I love that. I love being here with you all. I'm grateful to you all. Thanks for letting me share.
Thanks, Matt. That was really great. And I want to thank Roger for asking me to chair this month, and I really appreciate it. Thank you. Let's close in the usual manner.
Great job.